You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Soulforge Podcast. It's a geeky look at love, life, fandom, mental health, pop culture, and so much more. If you're into learning about yourself and the universe, Soulforge is your podcast. Each week, we have a surprising new topic. From stupid things we do for love, to product reviews, and there's almost always a fun guest host. Like and subscribe to Soulforge Podcast today.
Hi, everybody. This is Jim from Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. And we invite you to join us every week as we celebrate being a monster kid. Because a monster kid never ends. You're always a monster kid. And this is something we do every Monday on Monster Attack. We not only discuss these incredible films that we grew up loving, we share the experience. Come relive the experience with us each and every Monday at 5 p.m. right here on the ESO Network. Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. We're going to go back to a little supernatural type film. Interesting little film that was made in 1960, but we didn't see it here in the United States until 1962. It was made in the UK under the title The City of the Dead, but it was released 2 years later here in the United States as Horror Hotel. And it's interesting, whenever I get together with other monster kids at conventions and stuff, I bring this film up, and I usually call it The City of the Dead. And then most people say, oh, yeah, wait, that was the Horror Hotel one, wasn't it? So everybody knows it by two different names. Let me give you a little background history on this particular movie, and it's one that I especially like. It's very well acted, very well directed. It's just got a great look to it. And we're going to talk a lot about that here in just a second. In 1960, a company wanted to do a pilot for a television show, a supernaturally based television show. And they hired a writer to go ahead and write the pilot for it. That writer was George Baxt. And George Baxt had quite a reputation for writing supernatural and horror-type scripts, so he was the perfect guy. So he writes this pilot, which is about an hour long, maybe a little less than an hour long, very similar to what a pilot would be here in the United States for a TV show. But that got scrapped. And so the project got fired back up again, and Milton Subotsky, a name that should really ring some bells, was hired to adapt the script or whatever. So he lengthened it and turned it into a full-fledged feature motion picture script that runs about an hour and 16 minutes. Now, in the UK, it ran that. And then here in the United States, it runs a little shorter. There were a couple of minutes of dialogue that were cut out of the print that was released here to the United States. And again, we got a whole lot to talk to you about some things that this film went through here and there before its release here in the United States in 62. Milton Subotsky, though, probably, should be a very, very familiar name to you, because he is one of the co-founders of Amicus Productions. And Max Rosenberg was also involved with this production. And so this is considered officially the first Amicus production. So you might remember a few weeks ago, we did Amicus's last entry into horror films. We did the last one first, and now this is the first one here in season 8. And again, like I said, this is one I only saw a couple of times growing up. It made a quick appearance on one of the monster movie shows. And if I'm not mistaken, And some of you who grew up in upstate New York during the time I did can correct me on this. And I had a pleasure of meeting a few people that did grow up in the Syracuse area when I was up at Monster Bash a couple of weeks ago. And they remembered all of the monster movie shows and reminded me of the one on Channel 5. You know, I had been scratching my brain all these years saying, I remember seeing a few films on Channel 5, which at the time was the CBS affiliate. And I kept thinking maybe it was CBS Late Night, but there was for about a year and a half a matinee show, just like Monster Movie Matinee on Channel 3, which was the NBC affiliate at the time I was growing up, that showed a couple of monster movies here and there. And then they sort of gave up the ghost and just stayed with the CBS programming. But we couldn't remember the horror host name, but there was a horror host for about a year and a half on that channel. Of course, all of the channels up there have changed, but so I'm sort of just brainstorming not right now. But this one, I believe I saw for the first time on Channel 5. I believe that is where it made its first appearance, because it's not the kind of film that would have probably been on Monster Movie Matinee or on the one on Channel 9 with Baron DeMone. They tended to steer more towards the shock theater package or the Son of Shock theater package in those. So this one would have been a little off the wall. And it's a little bit of a talky film, but it's just so atmospheric. It reminds me a little bit of Roger Corman's The Undead, in that it was shot all on a soundstage, beautiful soundstage, and it, where Corman's had sort of a little bit of a lighthearted approach to it. You know, it had some lighthearted moments. This one does not have any of that at all. This is pure intensity, and it's quite a film to watch, and quite enjoyable if you're into supernatural type horror films. So let's talk a little bit about The City of the Dead. We'll get right to it with some of the folks you're going to see in here, some familiar and a couple of familiar faces, but most of them are going to be familiar to those of you that are heavily into British television and films, because this was a pure UK production. Of course, one of our lead guys and the guy that was really pitched when it came to the United States was Christopher Lee. Because, you know, the U.S. Distributors knew that Christopher Lee at this time had started developing quite a reputation through his Hammer film work. And so he plays a history professor named Alan Driscoll. And we're going to see him right in the very beginning as the film opens up, giving a lecture to college kids at this small university near where this is all going to occur. Now, the story takes place in a fictional town called Whitewood in Massachusetts. It's basically hinting that this is a type of Salem type scenario. It's we see actually the very, very beginning of the movie, we see a witch being burned at the stake. She puts a curse on the townspeople who arrested her, convicted her, and burned her at the stake. Of course, you know, history has shown us that no witches were ever burned at the stake in Salem. They were either hanged or well, they were sort of stoned. You know, they would put heavy rocks on them until they were crushed to death. But you know, in the movies, we burned a lot of witches here. Of course, witches were burned in Europe, so a lot of that is a throwback to what happened in the 1200s and 1100s and back then when they did burn witches. So be that as it may, he's talking about a famous witch by the name of Elizabeth Selwyn, who is played in this movie by Patricia Jessel. And Patricia, again, a very popular actress during her time, but she had a very, very short career. In fact, we would probably not see her after the early 1960s. So pretty much what you're seeing here, when you see her in this, she is right at the end of her career. And then tragically, 7 years later, she would pass away at the age of 47. But American audiences are going to remember her probably for two specific films that came out in the 60s. A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, which she made just before she died, and also a version of Hamlet that was released in the 60s. It released the year after this film was released. She died unexpectedly of a heart attack as she was working on a stage show on Broadway. Now, she had won some acclaim on Broadway in 1955, where she won a Tony Award for Best Supporting Actress for her work in Witness for the Prosecution. So she was well known to American audiences at this time, especially theater-going audiences, and she plays our witch. She is Elizabeth Selwyn, and she will also play a dual role because this is all going to take place, the movie, after this little flashback sequence of her being burned at the stake. We'll jump to contemporary time, or 1960, where she plays Elizabeth Selwyn's, I won't say ghost, but she receives eternal life from her turning over her soul to Satan. We're going to get a little bit more into that part of the story in just a minute as we take a look at some of the other folks we're going to be introduced to. Let's go down and talk about someone we're going to see opposite her, an actor by the name of Valentine Dayal. And he plays a character by the name of Jethro Keane. He is Elizabeth Selwyn's lover in this first sequence, where we see her being burned at the stake. And then he also commits his soul to Satan. And he and Selwyn remain alive for centuries in this little town of Whitewood. Elizabeth's new character ends up running an inn called the Raven's Inn, which is built on the actual site where she was burned at the stake centuries before. Now, her character in the 60s is known as Mrs. Newless. This is who we're going to see her as for the most part. And it's going to turn out, oh, by the way, folks, we're spoiling everything. If you haven't seen this film, you might want to pause it right now because, I mean, this is all stuff I've told you so far that you would know right off the bat. But the twists and turns and the hooks that I'm going to talk about from here on out might spoil the film for you if you haven't seen it. So I'll give you a chance to give us a pause and go round up a copy. This is a very, very easy film to find on a lot of streaming services. It's available for free. It's restored. A lot of them offered in HD, and good copies out there available. You'll see it probably under Horror Hotel, but if you go into your search engines on your streaming services, City of the Dead, you are going to find it under that too. There's a good cross-reference on most search engines between the two names. So now let's continue on with this. We were talking about Jethro Keane, and like I said, he and Selwyn are going to be principals in this. Jethro Keane we're going to be introduced to as he's making his way to Whitewood for a ceremony, a big satanic ceremony that's going to be held in the little town. It's just a little township in Massachusetts. It doesn't even show up on the map, as a matter of fact. Of course, it's this little throwback back to the 1600s and all of the witch hunts back then. Anyway, I'm getting off on a tangent. Let's continue telling you about some of the people you're going to see. Dennis Lottis is going to be playing the brother of one of our lead females in here who we're going to talk about next. But he plays a character by the name of Dick Barlow. And he's a little skeptical of all of this witchcraft talk because his sister gets very interested in the subject as she's taking Alan Driscoll's course in college. And this is what he's known for. I mean, he is an expert on this sort of thing and teaches a class in witchcraft in the United States. Christopher does a great job on this. Christopher Lee, I mean, really does. He's so overpowering and such a presence. Dennis Lottis, getting back to him, who plays Dick, was very popular in England as a singer. And also, he had a nice acting career with a few little entries here in the United States, but mainly in Great Britain. And is a very, very well-known actor over there, probably equally for his singing as well as for his acting. He was most popular in the 1950s, and he was born in South Africa, and then his family moved to Great Britain just before he started getting into show business. He was sort of a good-looking guy. I would say, you know, he's a pretty boy in a lot of the stuff that he does in this. So he is sort of the voice of reason in this, I guess we would say, because he's very skeptical about all of this witchcraft talk. Let's talk a little bit about his sister, Nan Barlow is the character's name, played by Venetia Stevenson. And she is the history student here who is taking Christopher Lee's character's course. And interesting gal. She was born in London, and both of her parents were in show business. Her mother was Anna Lee. And if you are a soap opera fan, Anna Lee is going to be a name that's very familiar to you, because she derived a lot of popularity on a television soap opera, General Hospital. She played the elder Quartermain, a matriarch of that family. I know that because my mother was absolutely addicted to that soap opera from day one. She watched every single episode of that soap opera from the time it came on television in the 60s to the time she died a few years ago. And she loved that show, never missed it. And as kids, and also when I was taking care of her for several years after she was struck down with Parkinson's, we knew never to bother Mom between 3 p.m. and 4 p.m. during the week, because she was watching General Hospital. So Venetia comes from some good acting chops. Her father was a well-known director, Robert Stevenson, and he directed such films as 9 Days a Queen, King Solomon's Mines, the original one in 1937, Backstreet, and Jane Eyre. So during the 30s and the 40s, very, very well-known and very respected. Just prior to the beginning of World War II, they moved to Hollywood, and her parents divorced in 1944. But Venetia, instead of going to live with her mother, Anna, decided to live with her father, who had just gotten remarried. And so she stayed in Hollywood, and she is in many interviews that she made later on in life, said that, you know, she would have a hard time relating to people who had worked like accountants or something like that, because all of her life she was in show business, whether it was over in the, you know, Great Britain or definitely in Hollywood. She was born in 1938, just before her family moved there. So pretty much all she ever knew was sort of a Hollywood existence. We lost her just recently. I mean, she passed away just last year in September, here in Atlanta, Georgia. So, and I had no idea she lived here in Atlanta, or I would have probably tried to track her down these last couple of years and see if we could have gotten an interview with her. She did not act for very long. She was never very confident, she said, of her acting ability. She was known more for modeling. She's a beautiful, beautiful gal. She acted right up until 1961. So about a year after she did City of the Dead, she did 3 more films: 7 Ways from Sundown, Studs Lonigan, and The Sergeant Was a Lady. And then she decided to give it up. She got married to one of the Everly brothers. And she said at that time, she decided, hey, you know, I really don't need to, you know, torture myself with trying to get an acting career. Because, look, she's not bad in this. She's really quite good as our femme fatale in this one. Before that, she'd had a regular appearance, so American audiences would recognize her from several television appearances, especially one, The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet, where she played the girlfriend of David Nelson in that. So that's where most people are going to know her. Other people we're going to see in here that are somewhat familiar, Tom Naylor, may not be as familiar to American audiences. He's going to be more familiar to British audiences. He plays Bill, who is Nan's fiance. And I confused him originally when I first saw this movie years ago for another fellow that I had seen in a low-budget sci-fi film, Missile to the Moon. He reminds me very much of the young fellow that was in that one. But very competent actor, had quite a career in the UK, just under 70 appearances there, a lot of television and films there. Then we've got Beta St. John, who plays Patricia Russell. She is one of the few American actresses that we're going to see in this. Now, this was shot in the UK, but Beta was born in the United States, worked a lot on Broadway and Hollywood, and then appeared later on in British films, like High Tide at Noon. She did two Tarzan films and did a horror feature, Quarters of Blood, with Boris Karloff. And then since this was originally going to be a television series starring Boris Karloff, sort of like a Thriller, that may have been her connection with the producers of City of the Dead, because she goes on and appears here. Now, she appears as the granddaughter of a minister who is living in Whitewood. And we'll get more into that storyline as we go on. But she runs a little antique shop there in Whitewood. And after her grandmother's death, is selling off some of their possessions. And she meets up with Nan when Nan goes to Whitewood to do some research on Elizabeth Selwyn. Okay, after the scene where we've seen Elizabeth Selwyn burned at the stake and cursing everyone, and I want to tell you something specifically about that I found sort of interesting. Some of the 2 minutes that's taken out of City of the Dead before Horror Hotel is released in the United States involve some of the words that she said while she's being burned at the stake. She offers her loyalty to Satan. I will go into it. It's a lengthy paragraph that the censors here in the United States found a little, well, they were a little offended with it, figured it was not going to be received well by the people that were watching the film. Anyway, we talk about this. This is the early 1960s, and some strange cuts and things were demanded by censors back then. This is taken out. And also we've got Jethro, who's in the crowd at this time, trying to just sort of lay low so that he's not grabbed by the crowd and tortured and burned at the stake as well. And he is saying, you know, he is making an oath to Satan that please give us, you know, eternal life or whatever, and we will do, you know, whatever you ask us to do. And if we fail to do that, you can do with us whatever, you know, do with our souls whatever you want. All of that is cut out. So, you know, which I think as a kid, if that had been in there when I first saw this in the early 60s, it would have explained the story a little better. But you sort of still figure it out. I have not seen the British version with all of that in there. But it's still, you sort of figure it out when you first meet Mrs. Newlis. Now, Jethro keeps his same name, Jethro Keane, when he first meets Nan. Nan is driving to Whitewood. And I got to tell you about these sets in just a second here. But as she's driving to Whitewood out in the middle of nowhere, like I said, this is a little township, just a little hamlet that's not even on the maps. She's got directions to how to get there given to her by Christopher Lee's character, Dr. Driscoll. She gets lost and gets additional directions from this guy that has a little gas station not too far from where Whitewood is. You can tell it's not traveled very, very much by cars. The roads are bad, very bumpy, a lot of potholes, almost suggesting that they might be dirt roads leading into, or dirt road, I should say, leading into this little hamlet. And that's where she meets Jethro. She sees this guy, it's at night, it's foggy. All of a sudden, he emerges from the fog. Some really nice camera work done in this film, by the way. And he says, hey, I'm headed to Whitewood. Would you mind giving me a lift so I don't have to walk the rest of the way? And he gets in the car and seems to know an awful lot about her, more than he should. And then when she gets to Whitewood, she turns to say, hey, you know, thanks, you know, here you are or whatever. And he's gone. Never hear a door open or close. He just disappears. Yeah. So that gives us a hint that something's going on. And of course, when we meet Mrs. Newlis, it's very, very obvious from the first little sequence in the movie that this is Elizabeth Selwyn. And there's a big plaque there in the Ravens Inn that says that in 1692, on March the 3rd, Elizabeth Selwyn was burned at the stake as a witch, and suggesting that this was the actual site where she was actually burned at the stake. Okay, going to just take a look at one more guy that you're going to, well, actually two, I'm sorry. I almost left one out. But Norman McGowan, who probably you're not going to recognize unless you're really, really heavy into British films, because that's pretty much everything he did was in Great Britain. Kidnapped was one that did make it over here to the United States. Had a very, very good career in film and television in Great Britain. And he is the one who plays the grandfather of Patricia, who was the antiques dealer. So now he is interesting. He's one of my more interesting characters. He's the Reverend Russell. He's blind. And he is living in the old church in Whitewood. And when he first meets Nan, he goes to the church for information. I mean, she tells Mrs. Newlis she's up there doing research on the life of Elizabeth Selwyn. And she asks, she says, "I see the plaque. Is this really where she was burned at the stake?" And of course, Newlis says, "Yes, yeah," and mentions the old church. And she says, "Yeah, I'm just going to look around town and see if I can find some folks that might know something." And she meets the Reverend. He won't let her into the church. He's got the door propped open, and he just says, "You need to leave. You need to leave this town. It's dangerous. The people are not to be trusted." You know, the whole thing. And then, because she's just wanting to see the church. It's a shame that it's falling apart like it is, and all of that. And we don't know how he became the minister there. We don't know if any of the people that we just sort of see in glancing, we see Nan walking over to the church and people sort of roaming around the town, a lot of fog. Oh, I love the look of this, is just tremendous. And it serves two purposes that we'll talk about here in a second, but she walks over there and then, meets him and then ends up in the antique store and meets Patricia. And there, Patricia loans her a book on Satanism or whatever, on witchcraft and Satanism in the United States that later on in the film, she finds out that it is Candlemas, which is the eve of a big satanic ritual that is held that involves sacrifice and that sort of thing. We'll get more into that when we get into the storyline. I want to take a moment to introduce us to our final character, Lottie, played by Ann Beach. She's mute. She's a housekeeper at the Raven's Inn. She tries to work against, I would say, Mrs. Newlis, a.k.a. Elizabeth Selwyn. So she's one of the good guys, tries to do it behind the scenes. When I first saw this film, I was convinced that was Patty Duke. This gal is played by Ann Beach again. She is a dead ringer for a young Patty Duke, but she is an English actress, and the only thing that you might have seen her in is this. Maybe nowadays, some of the work that she was in has made it over here to the United States, but back in the 60s, pretty much this would have been it, and not much more. But I was really stunned at how much she looked like a young Patty Duke. It was incredible. To the point that, even after I looked it up, it was like, no, it's not possible. Then, she is just almost like a twin, but it's not. So if you see this, you might think, no, Jim, that's Patty Duke. No, it's really not. It's really not. I've done a lot of studying on this one. I was amazed. I guess, as they say in life that, everybody has a double at some point. Okay, so I'm going to get into something about the look of this film. Everything is shot on a soundstage. So clearly, once I learned that this was originally going to be a pilot for a TV show, I understood that because the Brits shoot a lot on soundstages and really do it well. They do it extremely well. And I think one of the things when we are getting out into the country, and, even the driving sequences and all that, all shot on soundstage, just massive fog. I mean, fog everywhere, which not only gives you a spooky type atmosphere, just an uncomfortable feeling when Nan is driving. This is the first time we get to see the little township. driving in the middle of nowhere on terrible road, fog all over the place. The scene with Jethro Keane just sort of emerging out of the fog as a hitchhiker does a number of things. It not only just creates a great atmosphere, but I think also this is a great way to cover the fact that you're on a soundstage. Because, as I got older and more appreciative of film and how they make film, I would get a little discriminating on soundstage versus practical locations. And the one thing that would always give a soundstage away is the floor. Because most of them would have a painted concrete floor that would have a little sheen to it. If you've ever been in a television studio or whatever, any of the ones I worked in, they're all with sort of a battleship gray, as I call it. I think that was the actual official color when I was making monster models. But it would always have a little gloss to it, a little sheen to it. And so if you're watching a movie, it would give it away. A lot of sci-fi films, or you'd be on a rocket ship, it definitely was on a stage. The floor would give it away. So I think doing this with the fog and all of that, making everything dark and a lot happening at night, it covers the fact that you're on a soundstage. And folks, I got to tell you, the way they've laid out this little hamlet with the buildings and all that stuff, you've got one huge stage. So like when Nan leaves the Ravens Inn and goes to the church, we see her walking out. Now we're outside. We see all of the buildings. So these are all, practical stages, built on this big soundstage. It is really well done. And it's kudo to the art direction and folks that build all the sets, the set designers. It's a magnificent set. And you totally, totally fall into the fact that you're in a real little hamlet with a lot of fog. But anyway, Nan has this nice scene with Christopher Lee saying she wants to do more. She feels like there's more she could do for her degree, for her term paper. She wants to do it on Elizabeth Selwyn. And, Driscoll is sort of intrigued. And he says, okay, well, if you're really serious, I'll tell you how to get there. He says, I know where it is. I used to live there. And, I can give you directions because you're not going to find it on any map, and sends her off. But there's something about Driscoll that's not right. And you sense this early on that there's something more going on, and you will be right. Like I said, hopefully you've seen the film now, so you know what I'm talking about. But if you haven't, big spoiler alert that, Christopher Lee may be playing a bad guy. As if he's never played a bad guy before. So Nan goes, she meets with her brother. She has lunch with her brother and Bill. And, Bill's not real crazy about her taking her vacation from college. They're on their break. And he thought they were going to spend a lot of time together. Now she's going to end up going for about a week up to this little hamlet to do research. He's not crazy about it, but, he's her fiance. It says, look, I want you to be happy. I want you to do what you need to do. And, be careful. Her brother thinks it's just nonsense. This is all superstition and stuff. And what are you going to find? That's Bill's big, in a nutshell, his attitude is, what new are you going to find? She says, well, if I poke around there, I might find something new. That was so many years ago. There's nothing new out there that they haven't found already, but that is sort of his attitude. And a mutual friend of theirs is going to have a big birthday party. He says, look, you promised her you're going to be there. She says, don't worry, I'll be done in time. I'll be back in time to go to the birthday party, which was going to be in about 5 or 6 days. He says, all right, head up there. So as we said, she meets our Jethro character while he's hitchhiking on this old road, and he disappears mysteriously out of her car. When she gets there, we meet Elizabeth Selwyn, a.k.a. Mrs. Newlis, and we know that right off bat. So now we know something weird is going on in this town. And as it turns out, Elizabeth Selwyn's coven is still active. She has put together a new coven over the years, and they basically run Whitewood. That's why I'm curious as to the timing of some of this. This would be the only thing I would say to the screenwriters and the producers of the film. It's the only little weak. It's a little weakness, but I would have liked to know just a little more background on the Reverend to find out maybe they had been an active community and had a little church, a very active little church, like a little Congregationalist type church that many small towns in Massachusetts have. My mom and grandfather and grandmother belonged to one in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. But, was that the case? And then Selwyn starts a new coven and chases everybody away? We don't know. I mean, it just seems like here's this poor reverend that's just trapped in this church forever because he won't leave. He won't leave the church. Says it's the only place that it's safe. Now, his granddaughter has the little antique store and stuff. She has no problems going back and forth. But and we get the impression that she also has a residence somewhere else as well. So Nan gets up there. She's met Patricia. Supposedly some people coming in because we find out early on Mrs. Newlis, when Nan first gets there, says, "I don't think I have any room." And then Nan says, "Well, I just somewhere to sleep. It doesn't have to be fancy. I'm just doing this research." And then Mrs. Newlis goes, "Wait a minute. I may have a place right here off of the lobby, a little room off here that you might be comfortable in." And it's just a small room. And she says, "Okay, this will work for you. If you're comfortable here, and we've got a lot of people coming in for an event. Please feel free to join us." And she finds out later that night, they've got this little dance going on, and Newlis has been pushing her really hard to say, "Yeah, join us. But something strange happens. She hears singing, and not just singing. If you've ever seen any of the satanic movies from the 60s and 70s, when a coven gets together and they do their chanting, that kind of singing. And it seems to be coming from the basement. It's coming from the floor. And Nan has discovered this trap door in her room that it looks like it leads down to a basement. But she's having trouble. It doesn't have a little ring on it so you can pull the door up. She asks Mrs. Selwyn about it, and she says, no, you must be mistaken. There's no basement under that part of the inn. That's been all covered up because we had foundation problems, and so we covered it. We covered it all in to help bolster the inn's foundation there where it was falling in. But we later find out there is a basement there because Nan, her curiosity gets to her. She's read this thing about the candle moss and all that, and she manages to pry open the door and climb down into the basement, where she is kidnapped and hauled to a table, a sacrificial table, where the whole coven's there, all in their, black cowls and whatever, their robes and all of that, chanting. And then here comes Mrs. Newlis, a.k.a. Elizabeth Selwyn, with this huge knife, and boom, sacrifices Nan. So we get the idea that maybe there was something going on where Nan was set up. Because the way Mrs. Selwyn very subtly reacted to her and all that, everybody seemed to just sort of know she was going to be there. Jethro definitely gave us that impression. So it's almost like she was sent there. Gee, and I wonder who would be responsible for that. Well, we know that would be Alan Driscoll, who we later find out is a bad guy. Because when the scene cuts back to the birthday party that Nan was supposed to be there, Bill is there, Richard's there, they get talking, and Bill says, "I'm really worried because I called up there and the operator said there's no such thing as the Raven's Inn." So now Richard's getting a little interested too and wondering, yeah, maybe I'll go up there. He says, "I'm going to go up there and see if I can find out where she is, because I know she's got, she had directions to get up there." And he makes the same trek she did up there, talks to the little gas station guy who says, "Oh yeah, I remember that gal. Yeah, she's, you know, I haven't seen her since the night that I told her how to get there to Whitewood. And Richard goes. Now, we also see that Bill jumps in his car and follows Richard. Now, Richard doesn't know Bill's coming up there as well. Richard gets up there and meets Patricia. And, you know, Patricia says, yeah, I was really concerned about your sister who borrowed a book from me and then I never got it back. And Mrs. Selwyn said that she was gone. Now, also, Maddie, you know, our little Patty Duke clone, hands off something to Patricia. This all, I'm doing this out of order intentionally, but this has all happened all at the same time. These things are happening. Hands her a little locket. That was Patricia's locket. It was supposed to be one that helps keep evil away, and which Patricia had dropped on the floor under the influence. Yeah, so we've got all kinds of sub-stories going on here. These people have this kind of influence over her, get almost hypnotic, leading up to her sacrifice. So Richard and Patricia now, you know, Patricia says, is this your sister's? And he says, yeah, that's her. So now they know something weird's going on. Now, in between all of this, we have a quick scene with Christopher Lee, his character Driscoll, sacrificing a bird in a little area behind his study where he teaches his class. And so if you had any suspicions that he was involved with this in some way, then now you know. Now you know he was definitely involved. So I'm gonna cut to the chase a little bit on this. We've got Richard up there after these people. We've got Bill up there after these people. Bill, on his trip up there, now he's a ways behind Richard, because he didn't want Richard to see him, sees the image of Elizabeth Selwyn in the middle of the road. It causes him to crash his car. He doesn't get killed, but he has to basically crawl into town. I mean, he's hurt badly and manages to make his way into town later on while Richard and Patricia are trying to hunt all of these people down. To make a long story short, we find out that this sacrificial event that's going on wasn't just the Candlemas, but the day after as well. So two sacrifices are required. It's an annual thing, and they require two sacrifices. Guess who's going to be sacrificed as well? It's going to be Patricia Russell, the granddaughter of the Reverend, and she is kidnapped, and she is dragged to out into. They don't take her down into the basement; they take her out into the graveyard. And there's a key reason why they have to do it there for this second day of this procedure. Richard has, you know, been taken by these people too. He's got to witness all of this stuff, and Bill manages to make his way to the graveyard. Now, they know that these Satanists, this coven, would shy away from any kind of religious symbol. This is why I find it curious that they end up in a unsanctified part of the graveyard. Bill is close to this large cross that's at a grave. Richard's yelling out to him about that, and Bill, as he grabs the cross, is fatally wounded by Elizabeth Selwyn. She throws her big knife at him. She catches him in the back. Doesn't kill him quite yet, but he is able to get this cross and stumble his way towards the coven. And as there's a full moon, of course, you have to have a full moon. As he makes his way towards the coven, and some of the coven members approach him to stop him, the shadow that the moon makes on the cross, the shadow of the cross on these people sets him on fire. I know it sounds ridiculous, but actually it's pretty cool. Pretty cool scene, and he starts burning everyone up. And Patricia is saved. Richard is able to get loose. And Elizabeth Selwyn escapes. But they didn't do the sacrifice. They needed two sacrifices. They only had one, Richard's sister, Nan. Patricia and Richard, Bill dies in their arms. He manages to stay long enough to kill the coven. They make their way back to the Raven's Inn. They want to confront Elizabeth Selwyn, a.k.a. Mrs. Newless, and they find her there. but she has reverted back to her old self. And so we see the charred body of Elizabeth Selwyn. Some nice makeup as the film ends. Like I said, it sounds real crazy listening to me describe it. And I'd put this one off for quite a while. I wasn't sure if I was going to do this. And I just kept putting it off. But this just seemed to be a good time to do it since we had done the last Amicus film a few weeks back. So I said, yeah, let's do their first one. And I really do like this film, folks. So I'm not sure why I put it off for so long. But the name of the film, you will find it under Horror Hotel. But there are still some people that list it under its original title, The City of the Dead. It's quite a good film from 1960. I think it's one of those little unheralded treasures. This film made a little bit of money in Great Britain when it was released there. Did a little better here in the United States in 1962, I think on the strength of Christopher Lee and his popularity here in the United States. But it wasn't a huge blockbuster, and it didn't get a lot of showings on TV. Just, you know, there's scattered showings here and there. Saw one as a kid and then one in high school, and then that was about it. So I was really glad to find copies of this when I started streaming. And actually, I'd caught this, I think, for the first time. About the time I started Monster Attack, I went looking for this one and found it. So I've had one in my possession for quite a while now. Well worth a look, folks. Again, The City of the Dead, a.k.a. Horror Hotel. Folks, we'll be back with you again next Monday with an all-new episode of Monster Attack. And we thank you for all of your kind statements at the Monster Bash, some of the great ideas that you gave me, the emails I've been receiving. And for a couple of you listeners out there, yes, we're going to be doing a lot more Hammer films this season as well as some real gems from the 70s and maybe nibbling in the 1980s as well, as we do some things that are a little grittier with some new episodes here, and also revisiting some of the old classics that we've already done. Anyway, have a great week, folks, and we'll see you next Monday.
Hi, I'm Joe Heath.
I'm Tony Heath.
And we host the Watchathon of Rassilon,
a podcast where we're watching through all of classic Doctor Who.
Nope, we've already done that.
We did? Well, then now what do we do?
What do we two do? We review New Who.
Ooh, we two review New Who?
We do, just for you.
Who?
Not you, them, the listeners of the podcast.
Ah.
The Watchathon of Rassilon.
Now we review New Who, too.
Woohoo!
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.